Rodney, I'd like to dive into all of this information about the microbiome, but first I'll have to ask you to define microbiome and perhaps briefly redefine the human in relation to it.
Well, the microbiome is composed of all the organisms that live on and in us that are not the mammalian part of us. They're essentially the bacteria, viruses, something called archaea, fungi, and parasites as well that live on our skin and in our gut and respiratory tract, urogenital tract, many different body sites. And that's the microbiome. And so there are different locations in the body, again, that will house different components of the microbiome. They have become important because we're now recognizing that they are essentially, by cell number and by genes, a majority of us. So they're estimated to be a slight majority of cells, or some estimates go larger than that, and a significant majority of our genes, up to 99% of our genes, are actually from our microbes as opposed to from our chromosomes. And that's really rather stunning. Not surprisingly, if you have a majority of your cells and your genes active on and in you, then they are metabolizing food and handling environmental chemicals and breaking down and utilizing drugs as well. And that affects what our non-microbial cells, or mammalian part of us, actually sees. So they have a terrific influence on our interaction with everything that is external to our body, our environment, our food, our drugs.
When did this actually seriously start being researched? Because it seems, you know, from the way you describe it, it seems like a no-brainer, and it seems like our Western medical approach should already be way different than what it is.
Well, my opinion certainly is that embracing this and shifting toward using it more effectively in our health is overdue, and we need to do it as quickly as we can. There are bacteriologists back in the 60s that would tell you they knew all of this back then, and there is some evidence, in fact, that they were preaching, but nobody was really listening. So it's been really more since 2000, I would say, that the evidence has been dramatically mounting that this is really important, and it's important if we're going to lead healthier lives. And it explains a lot of the problems we've gotten into unintentionally with the epidemic of non-communicable diseases or chronic diseases that we're facing right now. So, in a sense, part of it's been known a long time, but it's never really come to the forefront until approximately the last decade.
Yes. Now, you shared some in the beginning of your book about the correlation between what's going on with the human and with the rainforest and the coral in the oceans. And I wondered what sparked this comparison for you. And did you write? Well, let's just start with that. And then I've got a further question in that direction.
Okay. Well, it was really serendipity in part, because back in 2012, I had a writing challenge, and that was to prepare a paper that best identified the single measurement you could take that would predict in a baby a life course filled with health from one filled with disease. And obviously, that would be really useful if you could identify the most important thing you could measure that would reflect that. And so I was pretty sure I had the answer from the decades of research on the immune system I'd done and early development, and tried to write the paper and was very unsuccessful at it and went to bed very frustrated, roadblocked, and woke up in the middle of the night from a dream with this idea that it was a very simple answer that the baby needed to self-complete with the microbes, with the microbiome, and that the baby was essentially, as a pure mammal, devoid of the microbes, incomplete, and that the extent that self-completion happened with a robust, diversified microbiome would be the best single measure you could make at birth for predicting the life course in terms of health and disease. And there are a lot of things that go into, you know, as we live our lives, we eat different food, we're exposed to different chemicals and drugs, and they certainly affect our health. But what could you really do in terms of the birth process and the measurement for predicting health? And that was really the answer I came up with, waking up in the middle of the night from a dream. And so I wrote a paper with my wife on that, and wrote more papers, gave more lectures, and the whole thing evolved into really this pretty simple concept of the completed self idea, and that is that we really are designed to be not what we were taught biologically, and that's a pure mammalian species human, but we're designed to be a walking coral reef or a mobile tropical rainforest. We have all of these thousands of co-partners, and they really connect us to our environment, and they provide vitamins that we need, and they help us metabolize our food and drugs and protect us in some cases from toxic chemicals, that we need to start working with them and understanding the importance of managing those co-partners. And we can do it. The great news is we've been wanting to, you know, change our metabolism, change our interaction with food, in some cases change our genes. And quite frankly, the easiest way to do that is by changing the microbiome rather than changing our chromosomes.
Right. And I just love the feeling when you just said we're a walking coral reef. It immediately made me feel more fluid and just...
Exactly.
Welcoming
I think
world.
There's an element of truth when people recognize that they're, in a sense, our ego goes down a little bit because we're not just the pinnacle human maybe that we were taught, but in many ways we're more awesome than we were ever taught as well, and that is that we're this composite of organisms on Earth.
Yes,
and it's a wonderful thing. We have microbial relatives in the most remote, extreme places on the planet.
Yeah. Well, tell us a little bit about what you call seeding of the newborn happening primarily at birth, and then maybe give an example of something you see that, this was incomplete, and where are we at as far as making that piece complete?
Right. So a lot of things have happened that have degraded or destroyed parts of the human microbiome, and it's estimated we're down 35% to 40% in diversity of the microbiome compared with human populations that can be seen now that are living in the old traditional ways in the Amazon jungle and other places on Earth that are basically have had very little encounter with westernized civilization. And we've done this unintentionally. We thought we were doing great things because we could have elective cesarean delivery, and it was deemed to be extremely safe. We could have food on delivery. We have frozen foods. We have the capacity to process foods. You can have a whole diversity of food available any time of the year and shipped anywhere. But in doing that, we actually wound up unintentionally causing some problems for our microbiome. So with birth, it turns out that, first of all, there are microbes in the placenta, and they do affect the baby's development and probably some of the development in the immune system, but there's not a lot of seeding that goes on relative to the baby's eventual microbial component prenatally. So while they're there in the placenta and they're affecting things, the big seeding event for the baby to acquire the microbiome is at birth and right around birth. And that happens ideally with natural childbirth and vaginal delivery. So that's where particularly the gut microbiome from the baby is seeded. And then skin-skin contact between the mother and the baby will also contribute to the skin part of the microbiome as well. Now, when that doesn't happen, when that is interrupted, essentially the baby eventually will acquire microbes. There'll be microbes that take up house in that baby, but they're not going to be the microbes donated by the mom. They're going to be microbes from hospital attendants and from the hospital environment, if that's where the baby's born. And those are not necessarily the microbes you would like to have in your new developing baby. And so that's been the problem, is we'd see elective cesarean deliveries, and we'd think, well, the baby looks great, all the parameters look great, but you're not realizing what the ramifications are of an incomplete baby at that point, and the fact that that will cause problems with physiological development, immune development, and risk of later life disease.
Can you take a baby that's been born by cesarean and take a vaginal swab from the mother and rub it on the baby or something? Or is that silly to think about? Or?
No, not at all. In fact, that's one of the alternatives that has been researched and is being utilized to some extent, and that was, I should credit Dr. Gloria Dominguez-Bello down at NYU, and her colleagues were the ones that originally did the study and showed that this, it's not a perfect substitution, but it is a very good substitution. The profile of the gut microbiome in babies that are vaginally swabbed is quite similar to that of the mothers and the donation that that baby would get through vaginal delivery. And so it really does a lot to complete the microbiome, you might say. And that is just one strategy that's being utilized, but it's a very simple one. And, again, it has the capacity to overcome some of the limitations when cesarean is medically needed.
Yes. I'm a bit curious about the plant organelle you spoke about in your book that is thought to have been a type of bacteria at one time.
Oh, right. The idea of the fact that our mitochondria, and this is a long-held idea from Lynn Margolis, again, that basically some of the eukaryotic cells in the past, ancient past, basically found it useful to simply engulf and incorporate through not through their nucleus, but their cytoplasm, what were then bacteria and eventually became something that still looks like a form of bacteria, but is basically part of the cells and contributes part of our energy use and energy production in the cell in a very, very important way. Makes a lot of enzymes that are really useful. And so that was kind of a wholesale stealing, I guess you'd say, of ancient bacteria that then became part of a eukaryotic cell and a number of lots of organisms as a result. There's another thing that, in the book I talk about how we can share genes across from bacteria and other organisms and eukaryotes as well. That's called horizontal gene transfer. And so there are a number of genes that actually do reside on our chromosome that look like they originally started back in bacteria and were simply shared across. And bacteria will do that with each other as well. They will share genes. So there is a process for that that can occur. So there's a lot of sharing that's gone on in the past. But again, the important thing is the opportunity to manage, much like you'd manage your garden out in your backyard, manage your microbial garden so that you can get the metabolism and the metabolic activity that's going to best suit your health.
Right. And I loved reading that, you know, of course, probiotics have been in vogue in alternative medicine now for quite some time, and prebiotics as well, but they're only like getting to the front cover now. I don't even know that they've made front cover of a Vogue alternative medicine magazine, if
right,
you know what
right.
I mean. But it's so exciting to hear that, because I know that a lot of medicines of any kind aren't really able to be used by the body. So the fact that they're talking about and researching and doing more work with adding these as something a person could take transdermally or vaginally or rectally, perhaps, I'm not sure, but it's creating a whole new thought process for all of this, which will of course turn into very possible good assists.
Well, absolutely. So I mean, both within allopathic medicine and beyond that, probiotics, prebiotics are going to have an increasingly important role. Because just consider at the moment that, I'm a toxicologist and I've been involved with safety evaluation, both of environmental chemicals and drugs, as part of my work and expertise. And the problem is all of the safety that went into the drugs that exist today and the environmental chemicals was largely geared toward the idea of protecting the human as a mammal, as a pure species mammal. So the microbial part was never included in the safety evaluation that went on. And not surprisingly, a lot of existing drugs and chemicals in use in industries and the environment have not been vetted for safety for the microbiome. And as they're being examined, we're finding out that they are indeed not that safe. And that they do some things to the microbiome that can be a significant health risk. So that our risk-benefit on existing drugs has shifted dramatically, as we've learned about the microbiome. And in order to make drugs more safe and more effective, we're going to have to alter the microbiomes or essentially know what the profile is in a given patient. And that would be an important part of this precision medicine idea. And then, if need be, give a probiotic along with a drug that will actually allow the drug to be safer and to be more effective.
Right.
And that's going to be, so even within allopathic medicine, it's going to be crucial to start to use microbial strategies to improve safety and efficacy of existing drugs, and certainly new drugs are going to be developed so that they are by design, working through the microbiome. At the moment, keep in mind that if you take a pill by oral route, if you ingest it, if you put a drug on your skin, if you have an inhalation, you have a spray as your medicine, the first things that see that drug are your microbes, because that's exactly where they're situated. They're on the skin. They're on the outside, essentially the gut lining that's exposed to the external environment, and they're in our airways. And so they are seeing the drugs first, and what they do with the drug determines what your mammalian part of you actually gets to see.
Right.
So literally, your mix, your profile of those microbes can determine whether a drug's effective in some cases. And one of the examples, digoxin, the heart medication, it's very good in some patients. It is ineffective in others, and it's potentially toxic in others. And it turns out that difference, that distinction, is all based on the level of one or two different microbial species in the gut.
That's amazing. What about the commensal bacteria versus the pathogenic bacteria? It's so interesting that it's the pathogenic bacteria that are more resistant to antibiotics and other drugs. And once again, in my mind, it suggests a huge shift in the Western medical thinking.
Well, it is, because keep in mind that there, first of all, there were serious bacterial pathogens, particularly back in the early 20th century, and typhoid and cholera and a lot of things that where antibiotics were really the miracle drug. So we assume that, well, if they're great for saving us from those, then it must be wonderful if we just kill all the microbes and kill all the bacteria. And that's sort of the path that we took is, if antibiotics work this well, then using more of them will be great.
And that
not realizing we were killing the copartner commensal bacteria that we needed. And we now know that a different strategy is that in many cases, the pathogenic bacteria need an advantage to get a foothold and actually cause disease, and that the extent to which you're well populated with those commensal bacteria, you're actually protected against some pathogens. And I detail in the book the whole story of how that strategy has been around since the 1980s in the poultry industry and really saved them from a big problem with salmonella. That was not only a problem for the birds, but also for the human consumer as well.
Yes, and I was glad to read about that. It's not only the physical effects they're finding or you're finding, but neurobehavior is also affected. And for instance, at this time, is there something known to give a depressed person some kind of microbe and create a change for the better for them, or is this still in research? only?
I would say it's still largely in research, but the research is very promising in terms of pointing to specific probiotic bacteria that can be administered. So there are certainly human trials with it in addition to the lab animal work, and what these are showing is that indeed your mood, your behavior, your neurodevelopment is terrifically influenced by things like your gut microbes. That they have three different ways that they can affect the neurological system in the brain, and they do so. And they will do it, among other things, by causing food cravings. So I use the example that, for example, that I grew up in Texas in the 1950s, and in addition to Mexican food, I probably ate a lot of fried chicken. So it turns out I cultivated bacteria in my gut that used that as an energy source. And now that I'm in my much older age and trying to shift to a diet rich in kale, that those microbes that grew up on fried chicken are not very happy about it. They're not going to be able to use that as an energy source, and they know what to do about it, too. They can basically send messages to my brain and do that says, yeah, no, you want fried chicken, and you want it now. So that there's a terrific effect of capacity of the microbes to cause food cravings. And clearly, if you're trying to eat a healthy diet, but you're getting those signals that are constantly bombarding you that you should be eating something that's not healthy, because that's what the microbes that are in majority in your gut want, then you're going to have a problem actually having diets be effective. You're working against your own body in that regard.
Right, and I think we're finding too much kale in the diet isn't very good either.
Yeah, exactly. So I, you know, in a way, I've advocated that it's going to be useful to yes, eat a healthy diet, but to get the microbes installed in your gut that are going to be wanting those healthier dietary components.
Right. Now, would you say if you're eating from your own garden that there's kind of a natural assist there?
Oh, very definitely. Very definitely. Yeah. Absolutely. And so you really want to, you can work both ends of that, and I think you'll be much more in sync in your body, and it's going to be easier to make the dietary shifts that you'd like to do.
Right.
And
as we all know, I'm sorry I'm cutting you off, but you have so much
amazing
information. I want to ask
Absolutely.
A few more questions in our time frame. As we're finding out more with cells and the stem cell research, et cetera, cells do seem to know on certain levels what kind to turn into. And I'm wondering what magic in the microbes, like, can you share something that's just blowing your mind about how a microbe works or a particular one?
Well, yeah, I mean, there are some things called keystone species. So not all bacteria are equal in terms of their individual significance for our body. And there are some that play very key roles in certain processes where if you were to damage that single bacterial species, that's a greater health hazard than damaging another particular one in a different bacterial family. So there are some of those that control, for example, our mucin layer in our gut. And that's the layer that's kind of the fence between that keeps some bacteria at a slight distance, physical distance from our own internal gut cells and our immune cells. And it's sort of good fences, good neighbors. You really need that mucin layer to be of a given thickness and turned over regularly. And these species of bacteria help to control that. And it turns out we now know that they are damaged by common food emulsifiers that are used to keep ice cream and gravies from separating, to keep oils from separating out of different foods, and they're very prevalent. And people thought they were very safe because they were testing them for the human mammalian safety, but they're not safe for some of the bacteria that regulate mucin. And so what happens if the fence gets degraded? Then you get bacteria that are basically promoting inflammation, and that essentially can lead to obesity and metabolic syndrome just by changing the distance, just by allowing them to get too close to the immune cells that are underlying the gut lining. And so we're now realizing that literally one or two species and their health is really important in potentially controlling things like obesity. And that's not to say that's the only way to get to obesity, but it's turning out to be a pretty well-defined and clear route that will get us there, and it involves just a couple of bacterial species.
Yes, and it certainly sounds completely relevant to the whole inflammation issue, which is at crisis level.
Exactly. It turns out you can't have most of these non-communicable diseases and conditions unless you have accompanying improper inflammation. So you've got inflammation that's not resolving, or is the wrong kind, or is misdirected, or that's continuing on in your tissues, and that's what allows things like psoriasis and asthma and even some forms of cancer to develop, but allows these things to be maintained and sustained and persistent. And so that's and your control of inflammation is really involves the microbes and the immune system, and they're growing up together and being able to learn how to interact well and what's safe and what's really not safe. So if you don't have those microbes there in the baby to help train the baby's immune system, then the baby essentially gets programmed for improper inflammation. That's one of the major outcomes.
Right, and I can only imagine this is why animals are licking their young.
Yeah, no, I mean, dogs, for example, are really great about sharing microbes among family members. And if you just watch their behavior, in fact, I talk about in the book the fact that if you look at how dogs greet each other, it's not usually it's not face-to-face, mouth-to-mouth. It's quite the reverse. It's nose to rear. and that we're now realizing that they're great sensors. They can pick up the chemicals that our microbiome is making, and they're detecting those things. And so that they're basically going to where the microbes are to find out the identity of another dog or in some cases, humans as well.
Just quickly, I'm curious about, in speaking evolutionarily, how do you see this affecting species that are close to extinction? I mean, is it just that certain microbes will, you know, last in certain animal populations for a certain time, or is that really not true?
Well, there's some really interesting observations that have just come out in the last couple of years, because we've always thought that species barriers, and that is whether a mating between two species and the hybrid that's produced, that those hybrids will often be lethal, they'll die, or they'll be sterile. And we've always thought that was exclusively controlled by the genes on the chromosomes and incompatibilities that existed there. It turns out there's evidence now that that can happen, but that, in fact, the microbiome can be involved in defining what a species is, and the microbiome and its interaction with the immune system. So you literally can have microbiomes in some animals that when they mate with another animal that is a subspecies or is somewhat different and distinct, the interaction between the microbiome and the immune system can determine whether or not those are separate species or the same species, whether the hybrid survives or is killed. And part of that is if animals are geographically distinct, they're growing up in different parts of the world, and they've done that for thousands of years, and then you bring them together and you say, well, maybe these are really the same species. If the microbiome and immune system don't play nice, if they're incompatible, and they produce inflammation, the immune system essentially will kill the hybrid. And that is a way to define now different species. And we see that's been reported in among mice, among wild mice, and also among certain kinds of parasitic wasps. So the microbes actually can help define what a species is. And as a result, they are part of this whole pattern of change that goes on with plants and animals as well.
Yes. Now, I know I'm keeping you a couple minutes later, but what can we do as adults then? What do you propose? You do say in your book human superorganism, that the road to a healthy microbiome and life gradually requires less effort. So what is the first step effort that you would recommend?
Well, I think that recognizing that loss of fermented foods that our ancestors used to have meant that we were also losing some of the prebiotics and probiotics. So I think we want to look for ways to not be a pure species, not overuse hand sanitizers. I think we want to recognize the importance of seeding the baby with the microbiome, that is absolutely critical, and we need strategies and birth plans that will allow that. And the fact that more and more medications for non-communicable diseases are not the only way to go, that we need a healthy microbiome, and that while it's better to work on that with the baby for long-term effects, that improving your diversity or microbiome at any age can be really useful. I describe my own experience with that here in my 60s and the benefits I've gotten from that within the book. So it's really important to eat a healthy diet, but to not be content with a microbiome that is already a problem that's associated with non-communicable diseases and doesn't have the diversity that is going to be useful, because we can change those things. So that's where probiotics, prebiotics in combination with a healthy diet come into play. So any age can benefit in terms of attention to the microbiome.
Right. Thank you so much, Rodney. I appreciate being able to speak with you today. And I should mention for everyone listening that you definitely do not have to be a scientist to appreciate what Rodney Dietert has written in The Human Superorganism. It's written for all of us, I believe.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Robin.
We've been speaking with Rodney Dietert, author of The Human Superorganism. Remember, folks, seed and feed and protect our robust, diversified microbiome. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, or sign up for weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. Podcasting is on iTunes at Tributaries Radio. I'm Robin Clay. Thanks for staying tuned.